Okay. The meeting of Early Childhood and Youth Development Policy Committee will come to order. And we'll try to get through these so we don't have to come back after session somehow or whatever.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to voice my objection to the way the deadline for amendments was handled. We asked if there was going to be a deadline, and we were told 8 p.m. last night. And there have been three amendments that came in after that deadline. The 1058A1 came in at 10:21 a.m. this morning. 1239A2 came in at 8:22. And the 1239A3 came in at 8:30. I thought there was another one as well.
Are you talking about on 1058?
Yes.
Representative Myra, at this point, the chair has been extremely lenient, and the only amendment all session that has been turned down was the one by Diane Loeffler, a Democrat. So we have to go on at this point in session, and I'm, as I said, I was taking all of your amendments too, or not necessarily yours, but any of the others. I know there's been various ones. So go ahead, Representative Winkler, and just present your bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that House File 1058 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Education Finance, I believe is what it's called. And Mr. Chair, members, I have the A7 amendment that I'd like to offer to put the bill in the shape I'd like to present. And Representative Myra, this is an amendment that came in this morning, and I apologize that that was slow and late. And
I'd
be
there was another one that came in late today.
We had a chance to talk on the floor, and I apologize that it was in as late as it was. But I will be more than happy to go through this author's amendment in detail if that would help make sure that we are getting this full window into the bill, if that would be helpful. So, Mr. Chair, I move the A7 amendment and.
In the shape the author wants?
Well, unless they'd like to discuss it first because they didn't have...
Well, we always put it in the shape the author wants, and then we can discuss it from there. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Okay, now go ahead and discuss it.
Mr. Chair...
Is there anything else you want in to get it in the shape
no,
you want?
No, Mr. Chair, just one amendment.
Okay, fine. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if you look at lines 1.2 and 1.3, those are just basically wording changes. Lines 1.0, and this, members, this is the A7 amendment I'm reviewing here. Lines 1.4 and 1.5 is adding an additional program to qualify for families to qualify as eligible. Lines 1.7 through 1.10. Add an additional category of individuals who are qualified for the scholarships, specifically parents who are under the age of 21 pursuing a high school degree or GED and has children ages 0 to 5. So this is actually expanding the children to those who are under the age of 3. Lines 1.11 through 1.12 is just wording changes. Lines 1.13 to 1.15 require simply that a schedule be produced by the director to explain the amount of money based on the rating system. Line 1.16 to 1.17 simply provides notice to eligible providers in their geographic area to know that they can qualify for the scholarship students or children, I guess. Line 1.18 requires the director to post timelines for the scholarship program. Lines 1.19 through 1.20 requires the director to take into account the various timing requirements of providers in a particular area to make sure that the scholarship program is working with the providers that are out there. Lines 1.21 through 1.25 requires additional notice, and this is at the request, I believe, of schools to make sure that they can plan for their next school year. lines 1.26 through 2.1 require screening for students as they come into the program, and the last section 2 of the amendment is basically providing some more flexibility to the director for startup in 2014, as this, which, as members know, begins July 1. So this is to help get the program up and running. That's the author's amendment. I don't think it's hopefully not horribly controversial, and I appreciate your accepting it. Members, just to the bill, House File 1058, I think, represents a really exciting opportunity for the state's youngest learners. We've had extensive testimony already in this committee about the need for children to have a supportive, high-quality learning environment at a young age. And we've also had, I think, a good presentation and a lot of discussion about the Many Minds proposal specifically. So I don't want to bring up a lot of testifiers and redo all this, but the essential idea here, just to remind everybody, is that we are giving scholarships to students at 185% of poverty. When fully phased in, that'll be about 20,000 Minnesota kids. They will be able to use those scholarships for any kind of quality-rated program that they want in the state, whether that's in a school, whether that's Head Start, whether that's at a child care center, or whether that's in a licensed family care center. Anything that meets the quality rating standard is an eligible program under this bill. We've worked extensively to make sure that schools can be a part of the group receiving funds, and we are as much as possible hoping to inform parents about quality options in their community and empower them to make the choice that works best for their students. And what I think is the most exciting part about this is that we already have a $1.4 billion child care industry in Minnesota. And what this promises to do with enough resources is leverage up the quality of that entire industry, that entire system statewide of where kids are in child care, to improve the learning environment that they're in. And I think by this combination of quality ratings and scholarships to make it accessible for more kids and the additional funds that will be available to those providers, we can make a huge difference for not just the scholarship recipients, but all the kids in Minnesota who are in child care settings. And with that, I'd stand for questions, or we can go to amendments.
Do you want questions first or amendments?
Oh, I'm fine with either or.
Whichever you
want. We'll do the amendments first.
Okay. I believe, are these all yours, Representative Francis?
No, I have the A1 and the A2.
Okay. Why don't we do those first then? Do you want to move the A1 amendment?
I'd like to move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. A1 amendment is moved. Do you want to explain it then?
Yeah, I'll just read it. This A1 amendment says the director may not require a rated program or prospective program to be represented by a labor organization that has been elected and certified with the right to represent child care providers in their relations with the state. For purposes of the subdivision, child care providers means providers are licensed under Chapter 245A and who provide child care assistance services under Chapter 119B. Just want to make sure that that the money stays with the child.
Okay, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I oppose the amendment. We are obviously mixing two separate issues here. The bill that is moving forward to permit an election for labor representation for some child care providers is tied to the CCAP program, which is not what this bill is about. And members, I don't think we want to start putting in language like this that may just cause problems and confusion later when it's not really related. And I understand you oppose the union bill, but that's not what we're dealing with here, so I oppose this amendment.
Representative Francis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Winkler. I just want to make sure that down the road we don't have to come back to the legislature for an issue where perhaps the labor union wants to go after the scholarship money, so that's why I'm putting it in place.
No response.
Well, Mr. Chair, the idea of requiring a rated program to be represented by a labor organization, there's no authority in statute anywhere to do that. That's just not going to be an issue.
Representative Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, there's no authority for a labor union also to go after independent businesses, but yet we're doing that anyway. So
It's a rhetorical comment, I think. But do you want to answer it or just...
That's why there's a bill being moved to allow them to do that. There is no authority. So if you wanted these programs to be covered by labor or not, somebody would have to pass a bill. We don't need to do this amendment.
Can we vote?
I think we can go ahead.
Then all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no.
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 Fails. Representative Franzen, do you want to... Oh, wait. Representative Franzen, first, would you want to move the minutes?
Oh, I'll move the minutes
from
yesterday, thanks.
Representative Franzen moves the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. You won.
Thanks.
Representative Franzen, you want to do A2?
I'm sure batting...
500?
500.
Very good.
I'd like to move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Franzen moves the A2 amendment. Go ahead and explain it.
Yes, perhaps this one would be a little bit more palatable for Representative Winkler. The director may not deduct from payments to a program serving a scholarship recipient any dues, fair share, or mandatory fees for purposes of a labor organization that has been elected and certified with the right to represent the program in their elections with the state.
Representative Winkler.
And Mr. Chair, members, I oppose the amendment. Again, we would actually have to pass separate legislation to permit programs to be required to be represented by a labor organization. It doesn't really match up. And so I think we're just putting extraneous language in here that is really not protecting us from anything. So I would ask for a no vote.
Member Franzen, did you?
We'll just go back and forth again.
Okay. Okay, all in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
It fails. This is the A3 amendment.
Mr. Chair, that's mine.
Okay, Representative Myra, do you...
Actually...
Oh, I'm sorry. There's the A8
Chair,
amendment.
That's amendment A3 is replaced by Amendment
A8. I apologize. I knew that and I forgot.
All right.
Representative Myra moves the A8 amendment. So go ahead.
Thank you. This amendment will give parents and families the greatest amount of choice, and they will be able to choose any program.
Okay. Then Representative Winkler, did you want to comment?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I think this, I oppose this amendment as well. I think it's important that we have this concept of a prospective program in here because obviously we're going to have some issues and some challenges in creating enough providers who are quality rated to use these scholarships. And the idea behind a prospective program is that providers who are committed to getting rated are still eligible for the scholarship funds as we gear up. So I think it would be a mistake to take that out. And I also, this also eliminates the requirement that families use the scholarship within 10 months of receiving them. Again, we don't want to tie up the money if people are not going to use it. So I think these are important guardrails, if you will, or important limitations in the bill that will help make sure the money is used appropriately. So I would oppose the amendment.
Representative Meyer, did you want to just vote? Okay, then all in favor of Representative Meyer's A8 amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed, no.
No.
No. Fails. Are there any questions on the... Oh, wait. Are there any testifiers that want to otherwise testify? Mr. Pritchard? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just state your name, and you've been around a while.
Been around, yes. Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I wanted to testify in opposition to the bill. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Certainly, we all want to improve the well-being of our children and improve parent choices. However, I'd like to raise some concerns about whether the massive increase in funding for preschool programs proposals under this bill, over $325 million over the next 3 years, will actually improve the well-being of our children and improve parental choice. I believe it won't, and in fact will cause other problems. First, there is no evidence of long-term benefits from these preschool programs. Consider Head Start. There have been major studies done on and review of studies on Head Start in 1985 by HHS, 1997 by the General Accounting Office, and a 2003 study of 2,800 Head Start kids and 43 Head Start programs. They all did not find long-term benefits. And most recently, a 2010 study of nearly 5,000 kids in Head Start programs found first graders in Head Start were no better off than similarly situated kids who didn't go through Head Start. And the math skills of three-year-olds were actually lower. Second, there are harms which will come from putting kids into preschool programs too much. A 2005 study from Stanford and Berkeley looked at data from 14,000 kindergartners from a National Center for Education Statistics study. Their study found harm to young children's social and emotional development. Quote, "We find that attendance in preschool centers, even for short periods of time each week, hinders the rate at which children develop social skills and display the motivation to engage classroom tasks, as reported by their kindergarten teachers. We find that the decrement to social development is not limited to one domain, externalizing or aggressive behavior. Our analysis reveals that this drag on the typical pace of social development is moderate magnitude and extends across all three forms of social-emotional growth. Third, there is no evidence that rating systems will actually improve child outcomes. Here's a quote from the Parent Aware third year review by MELF in November of 2010. Quote, "No definitive patterns of linkages between rating categories, program characteristics, or proxy scores, and child outcomes were identified." On top of that, according to Parents Aware evaluation, large centers and Head Start programs all receive 4-star ratings. As already mentioned, the Head Start programs show no benefits and even some negative outcomes. If programs which aren't successful receive 4-star ratings, what does that say about the efficacy of the proposed rating system? Fourth, the rating system and the state money will pull in private and religious daycare preschool programs into the state's controversial one-size-fits-all approach to curriculum and assessments. This happens because to receive a 3 or 4-star rating, recipients of the scholarships must line up their instruction and assessments with the early childhood indicators of progress. What are these standards? Here are a few examples. To begin to develop awareness, knowledge, and acceptance of own gender and cultural identity. Use play to explore, practice, and understand social roles and relationships. Develop an awareness of self as certain abilities, characteristics, and preferences. These suggest they are targeting gender and cultural identity issues for preschool children. Family structure and sexuality issues at a very early age. And finally, this approach of additional state regulation and hence control could reduce access to child care for middle-class families. How so? By receipt of tax dollars, these programs will be required to adopt the state's curriculum and assessments and other mandates and requirements. Again, added costs. Rest assured, these higher costs will be passed on along to parents, the consumers of preschool programs. Higher costs mean less access. In conclusion, there's a lot of talk about the benefits of early childhood programs. However, the research I've seen suggests the exact opposite. There's no lasting benefit to children, and there are even some negative consequences for children who attend preschool programs. And there are problems with the effect of the QRS system and increased state regulation and control of preschool and early childhood programs which adopt the rating system. We want all to help children. I don't believe the massive increase in funding for preschool programs, while certainly well-intended, will do that. In fact, it could have the opposite effect. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Now, to questions, Representative Franson, I think you...
No, I'll defer for now.
Oh, okay. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of different questions. And first of all, what I'd like to know is, as I know aware, whoever wants to answer this, I guess Representative Winkler, if you want to answer this, but I know there's the... The rating system that's currently that I'm familiar with is Parent Aware. Are there any other methods to get for programs to be rated out there? Is that the only one that we're familiar with?
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, there are various organizations that do accreditation for child care programs. The one I'm most familiar with is the one my kids attend at a Lutheran church. So it's at a, they go to chapel. It's a religious type of preschool and child care center. And they have gone through an extensive accreditation process over the number of years in order to demonstrate their quality. Under this bill, programs that have met those kind of accreditation standards are fast-tracked, if you will, into the quality rating system, as well as Head Start school-based programs and a few other things. So the places that have a known track record and demonstrated that in some way are fast-tracked into the quality rating system, if you will, and others have to go through a kind of a step-by-step process.
But that's still the parent aware. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. But that's still the parent aware program, rating program. That's the only, for this scholarship, that's the only rating system that's available to be rated.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, yes. In order to qualify for the scholarship, you have to be, it's only the parent aware system that we're talking about.
Okay. Thank you. The other question I have then.
Oh, Representative Howe.
Thank you. Sorry. Having this block doesn't help me with that. But the other question, I understand, Representative Winkler, that there's that this is a layered, this scholarship goes on top of, if they've got to qualify for other programs to get to this scholarship.
Representative Winkler.
I'm still going, I just paused. Could be an effect from
I
one of my
that
other
that was a question. Is it correct what
no,
you're saying?
No, if I'm wrong, please correct me, but and I understand that in some of those other programs, the families have to pay a portion of that, of those programs. And I should preface this, that I believe that that programs where the families are involved have skin in the game, and in other words, that have some fees put forward, are actually, when they have to put fees forward, they got to put their own hard-earned dollars into it, they are more involved in it, more concerned about the outcome of that. What I don't see here is, what I want to prevent is they take the scholarship from this and put it and use it to pay those other programs, and then they don't have that personal input. If what I'd like to see done is, am I right on that, Mr. Representative Winkler?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, the idea is that these scholarships will help fill gaps. So in that sense, you are correct. And I'm not an expert on CCAP, but I believe I'm sure for almost every family there is a copay of some kind. And this program doesn't eliminate anything like that. But the whole point is that we're trying to build this around the child first, not trying to create this as a program to help parents work. And so the idea is, not only do we not have a copay required in the bill, doesn't mean that families won't have to make up some difference somewhere if they pick a different program. But once they're in, they stay in. They're not qualifying 1 month, not qualifying another month, where the kids get kind of moved around. The idea is to kind of use this as a glue to keep the kid in place in a quality program of the parents' choosing.
Representative Howe, do you?
And I gather that, and I support that. But my concern is going back to that, you know, to pay those. What I don't want to have happen is if they don't have the skin in the game in those other two programs, I'm concerned that they're not going to be as active and participating if they are able to use these funds to purchase their way into those other processes and that make that copay. And so that's where I would be I'd feel more comfortable supporting this if that separation was there. And I know I expressed that to the people that brought this bill forward to you, and I don't see that these amendments have taken that concern out of there. So that's my concern with it, is I think that there should be a separation there. So those folks that are meeting those requirements for those other programs aren't using these funds to meet that.
Well,
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, that you are correct. There hasn't been any kind of copay type language included in this bill or any of the amendments. But, you know, even if families had to pay nothing for this, you're still serving the same purpose. And the purpose is to make sure that the kid is held harmless as much as possible from the ability or inability of the parents to make sure that they have the money to get there. I mean, I've talked to folks who run child care centers at homeless shelters or who serve a lot of homeless families. there might just not be money from month to month in order to make these kind of payments. And we do not want that to be a reason for kids who are in the most distressed families from being able to stay in these programs if that's what their parents decide is the best for them. So I guess I just look at it a little differently. I think if you're worried about your kid and you want to get them in a quality program and you want to do what's best for them, you've got skin in the game. The money isn't the skin.
Representative Myra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, could you explain how many scholarships this will provide? Just an estimate.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, the idea is when it's fully phased in the next biennium at $150 million, it would be about 20,000 kids. So it would be 20,000 scholarships.
Representative
Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, about how many children are being served now?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, by what?
Representative Myra.
Head Start. We're adding on to what is already being provided. How many children are
Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, I actually don't know the total number who are being provided. I know that this kind of figure was developed by Mr. Grunwald, and he is the one who's kind of modeled the numbers, so he can probably explain that better.
Mr. Grunwald, do you want to be a lifeline?
I'm not drowning, Mr. Chair.
Rob Grunwald, economist at the Federal Reserve Bank, providing information today, not for or against any legislation. Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, in modeling this, right now we are only reaching about 15,000 three- and four-year-olds in a high-quality program, which is less than a third of that low-income population. So when we're able to get up to that larger amount of 20,000, we're able to expand it. Actually, let me just pull up my number here. It's actually a little bit less than the 15,000 total, but we're able to, once we expand it out to three and fours, that's essentially doubling the amount of kids that would be in a high-quality program. So we'd be moving it from one-third up to about two-thirds.
Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler and Mr. Greenwald. So there still would be additional children out there that would meet the criteria, would be on a waiting list, or maybe their families would want the program?
Mr. Grunwald.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Myra, the way we modeled this is that we modeled this relative to other programs that are in other states, and that we anticipate that take-up rate to be about 70%. Okay. So getting to that $150 million amount, we'd expect that there would be about a 70% take-up rate, and that would fill in all that amount.
Very good. Representative Myra. Mr. Chair, I do have another question. About how much would the average scholarships be? Was it the A7 amendment that changed that amount, or how do the scholarships work?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, I asked the same question, and I did some really tricky math and figured out that about $150 million divided by 20,000 comes out at about $7,400 per child.
Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, so is it the same amount across the state, or is it?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, no, it's based on regional differences, and so this is an average number, or maybe average is not the correct statistical term, but it is a blended number at any rate, based on regional differences, and so $7,400 is not enough for a high quality program all by itself in the West Metro. So it's built on the assumption that there's, at least in my experience, and I wish it was, but this is based on other programs being available as well. So it's the concept of layering as well as regional differences.
Representative Myra. Okay, then Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, I guess I have a couple questions. One is kind of a technical one, so I'm just trying to understand the timeline for the awards of the scholarship as it relates to the dollars in fiscal year 14, 15, and 16. And it relates to your amendment on 2.30. So we have $78 million in fiscal year 14, which begins July 1st of this year and ends June 30th of 14, I believe. And interrupt me when I'm going off track here. Then we have scholarships awarded beginning April 1st. So I'm just wondering the timeline of the scholarship that could be awarded starting April 1st and one that would end, would those have to end by June 30th? And how would you award a scholarship for participation in the fall? We're trying to understand the math between fiscal years.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I actually understand your question for 2013.
So 2014 begins July 1st of 2013, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So our first dollars of $78 million begin to be appropriated on July 1st of 13 and have to be spent by June 30th of 14. So I'm wondering when the first scholarship could be awarded in fiscal year 14, and when the last scholarship could be awarded in fiscal year 14, as it relates to your amendment that mandates that they begin on April 1st of each year.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, that's why we have this additional language on page 2 that you referenced. We create an expedited process to get them eligible or get them ready for scholarships for eligible programs that start in the fall. So they were, you know, we're ramping this up. Obviously, the director is going to have to be able to move quickly right away in order to get scholarships in the hands of kids who want to start a program in the fall.
Representative Barrett. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the scholarship would be awarded in the spring for residents, wrong word, in the fall. And that scholarship awarded in the spring would cover the whole year?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, that's the idea. And this is specifically to accommodate schools who have to start making enrollment and planning decisions for the fall as early as April. So the idea is that we make sure that the school-based programs that are trying to figure out what rooms they need, what teachers they need on hand, know about how many kids are going to be coming in based on these scholarship awards.
So then those scholarships will have to be awarded by June 30th of that year. They would have to be awarded in a three-month period starting April and ending June for that fiscal year, correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Baird, yes, I believe that is the case. I'm not sure that the fiscal year of the legislature or the state matters on an ongoing basis.
Right, sure.
Representative Barrett.
So then that leads to my main question, which is the quality rating system. And how many facilities currently are rated? And I should know this because I'm sure we've talked about it in prior committees. I just don't remember. And I'm specifically wanting to know metro versus outstate. So how many are there? How many are rated?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I would ask Erica Moss from PASSER to come and answer that question. I think she could probably give you a little bit better detail about the rollout of Parent Aware. It's supposed to be fully phased in by 2015, according to the Race at the Top. And obviously this has been built out regionally in models and so forth, but I couldn't give you an aggregate number.
Ms. Miles. First state your name.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Erica Moss, Parent Aware for School Readiness, and Representative Barrett. I don't know, you're asking specifically about the split between metro area and greater Minnesota. I don't have those numbers. You're looking, the total number of rated programs right now is 529. And the ratings are available currently in 22 counties. A mix of metro area and greater Minnesota counties.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, the only thing I guess I would add that might be helpful is if you look on the bill at lines 2.1 through 2.5, it's the definition of a prospective program, and this makes clear that the scholarships, and this, well, the definition doesn't, but it kind of is the concept here, that the scholarships are available to programs that make a commitment to get rated, and then after 2016, they have to have some reason that they aren't rated in order to qualify as a prospective program. So we're anticipating a ramp up in the quality rating system and the number of providers that are out there.
So do we know,
Representative Barrett,
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, do we know how many, how likely that is to happen given the number of centers we have in our state? In other words, we have 529 right now rated. How many are there? And how long has the process been that 529 have become rated, given bureaucracy, all kinds of things? And I'm wondering about how many will have rated during this period of time and how many agency or how many centers we would be unintentionally leaving out of a scholarship program.
Representative Winkler.
I think Ms. Miles can answer that.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Barrett, so we have targets set forth to add to the 529 about another 1,000 programs in the calendar year, 2013 calendar year. And the target for the period between now and 2015 is to have about 30% of eligible programs statewide rated. And as Representative Winkler pointed out, there's a clause in this language that allows a two-year period when essentially any eligible program could accept a child with a scholarship, so long as they're working toward a rating. So they don't necessarily have to have gone through the rating process or be in the rating process at this point. They just need to be willing to serve a child with a scholarship and commit to going through the rating process.
So just one final question. So we believe then in a couple of years we'll have 70% of the eligible centers not rated?
We believe that we'll have 30% rated. That's correct, Representative Barrett. Okay. So 70% not rated, yeah.
Thank Representative Kreischer.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Winkler. Actually, this is the type of bill I was hoping to hear while I got on this committee. So just a couple of questions, maybe two technical, some technical ones. Starting off with subsection 5, the scholarship amount, and I just, based on earlier discussions today, of course I'm going to ask the geographic question. What are the cost differences? You mentioned the West Metro versus, say, the Crow Wing County and the Morrison County. What determines the cost differences?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Grunewald can probably give you an overview of the market. I only mentioned the West Metro because that's where I pay through the nose. And so I don't know much as much about where other people pay through the nose.
Mr. Grunewald.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, in terms of looking at using the child care market rate survey here in Minnesota, and the most recent survey provides four different geographical areas or clusters representing different tiers of basically how much it costs. And we use this to essentially look at, model out the various scholarships. So the metro area, the so-called pay through the nose area, we modeled that at a full year, and we're also informing this by our MELF scholarship, which was full year was a $13,000 scholarship. We have this modeled at $13,728 as a full day scholarship. And then the lowest tier would be about $9,400 in terms of the cluster. And that's how we were able to model that geographic differentiation. And the market rate survey is essentially looking at those rates and assessing what the market is in those four clusters.
Representative Kreischer.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And Mr. Grunewald, is that correct?
Yes.
We have a range of 13.7 to 9.4. And where does that fall specifically? I'm assuming the 13.7 is in the Metro County area. The 9.4 would be what other quadrants?
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Grunewald.
What we could do is provide you exactly where, it's not exactly by quadrants,
okay. But
in terms of the lower tiers, those tend to be more, the two lowest tiers tend to be more rural areas. The third area tends to include some areas that would have a higher population, and then that fourth tier is the more metro area.
Thank you, Representative Kreischer.
And thank you. And so a follow-up, is that based primarily on supply and demand of the demographics of the population?
Or Mr. Grunewald.
Mr. Chair, basically it's actually a market rate survey. And for technical questions to that, I know there's experts behind me that can answer the technicalities. But it's actually taking the market rates that are charged by providers in those areas. So it's looking at the market. In that sense, since we're using price, it would be supply and demand.
Okay, that helps. And
Representative Kreischer.
And Mr. Grunewald, you had mentioned you modeled this after other states. What negative sides, if any, have you seen in other states that might bring something to pay attention to?
Mr. Grunewald.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. What I meant by modeling there is that I was looking at the take-up rates in other states. So other states that do offer preschool to a population, you know, the upper end of that take-up rate has been 70%, And so we use that take-up rate as a way to sort out, even though this would be available to all, what we would expect that take-up rate would be. This particular style, this particular model that was researched with the MELF pilot and has been now used in scholarships in a couple different ways here in the state, is somewhat unique here to Minnesota. That is, that we're going directly to families, providing them scholarships, giving them a choice of programs that are a variety of choices, whether it's public school-based or Head Start or a child care provider or a half-day preschool program. So in some sense, I wasn't using another state as a basis for providing this model. This model was really developed on what we've learned here within Minnesota.
Representative and Representative Winkler and Mr. Greenwald, I'm not sure who would be the best, but does this, because I'm all for it, does this possibly create a situation of competitive education at this level where we're going to see competition for vouchers or competitions for students? So the school districts may be increasing their programs to get better ratings, and I'm not sure if the school districts have to get rated. But does this create that situation that could be very beneficial for students at that age?
Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kreshaw, I don't quite look at it exactly that way. I think that a lot of child care providers are going to want to have access to the funds that these kids are able to bring with them. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, they're going to have to do a lot of professional development and develop a higher quality program. I think that helps not just the kids with the scholarships, but all the other kids who are at that child care. It also helps all the kids who come after them, even if no scholarship kids show up, because that program will have learned a lot about how to provide a more supportive and protective and stronger learning environment. So I think, I don't know if it fosters competition among them all, but I think it creates a real incentive for higher quality that I think leverages up a whole child care industry to serve kids better.
Okay, and so to that point, and it's okay to use the word competition, by the way, it's a good word, but I appreciate where you're going with the incentive. Does this set up any scenario, I'm thinking of my rural areas, where the school district may be directly competing with a Head Start program in a bad way? I mean, I'm just trying to look at numbers. I mean, we're always trying to figure out, because we have such a limited amount of kids at our level, so any insight to that, what you've seen with other states or programs?
Representative Winkler.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kreshaw, I mean, parents will be making the decision about where the kids go. Mm-hmm. So if enough parents in the community feels like the school or the Head Start or the family child care providers aren't doing the job, they will have, you know, they'll have the ability to move. And hopefully by structuring it in the way we have, we've created enough of a planning process so everybody can live with that movement over time. And so I think, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure that it'll create a competitive environment. I tend to think these people like to work together. And I know in Wilmer, and I'm a little foggy in the details, but the basic thing that happened there was that the school became a resource for child care providers throughout the region around there because they had a lot of the expertise there. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't compete with each other in the sense of trying to grab as many dollars as they could because of the kids. They actually worked together to improve quality at all their programs. So, mm-hmm.
Representative Kreshaw.
Just cooperation also works, Representative Kreshaw.
I agree. You know, we're so close. I agree. Thank you, Chair. A couple other just quick questions on the bill. Section 5, the director shall not consider local funds allocated to support an early learning program when layering scholarships around other assistance programs. I'm assuming this, and I think I saw something back earlier for the CCAP fund. Does this allow for duplication? Could somebody use the cliche, work the system?
Representative
Winkler. Representative Kreshaw, the language that you referred to about local funds is about school districts particularly who've levied to provide education programs, and we don't want to punish people who've stepped up and done their best and want it so by taking away their funds. And so that's what that language is intended to accommodate, not related to any particular individual.
Okay. Okay, Representative Myra.
Representative Winkler, I'm looking on page 3, and there's a number of references to data. Line 3.7, the child who receives a scholarship must complete developmental screening, and then down near the bottom of the page, it talks about a student identification number. Would you please comment on the data that will be collected and how it will be protected and what it will be used for?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, the data collected is to try to determine whether or not this program is working, whether we're actually seeing the results in child development and educational attainment and so forth. So that's the purpose of collecting it. It's really about accountability. And the data itself is private under the Data Practices Act, which is the same way that data is treated on any public program. So if you have individuals who are engaging in some public assistance program, for example, that their data that the state collects is private, and this treats it the same way. Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, I'm not sure that they could opt out. I think they would be warned, and that's a good question. That's something that we should probably talk more about. And I don't know if anybody else has an answer, but I think to the extent possible, we want to protect their data and make sure we're getting a good sample. But the question of families choosing to opt out is a good one that we should explore, and I don't have a quick answer for you. Dr. Cadigan can answer that.
Mr. Chair, Karen Cadigan, Director of the Office of Early Learning. Mr. Chair, Representative Myra, the two issues that you raised, the first with regard to developmental screening, one of the choices for screening is for, there are several choices. One is for parents to go through screening, another is for parents to opt out for the reason of their choice. So the presentation of developmental screening includes an option to opt out. With regard to the other data, as Representative Winkler stated, the collection of data will be very similar to that of the rest of the K-12 system that uses the MARS ID system. And so those data are collected, as Representative Winkler said, under the Data Privacy Act. And I'm not clear on the opt-out pathways for that, but I can certainly check and get back to you.
Representative Myra. Okay. Representative Franzen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, do you support rating public schools and allowing scholarships to students so that parents may be able to, you know, go to a school of their choice for their children?
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, I do not support school vouchers, and I do not support the movement to privatize the K-12 education system. This is very different, however, because we have in place a private marketplace, and we have various programs already like CCAP that subsidize families to be able to participate and have access to that private market. What this bill does is to provide a child-focused approach to high-quality early childhood and to use that as a lever to improve quality for all child care in the state. So in my mind, this is the exact opposite of a school voucher, which basically seeks to take money out of the public education system and move it into a private education system. This is using public money in order to change the type of quality that is being offered in a private system, or a predominantly private system anyway.
Okay. Interesting. The Office of Early Learning, Representative Winkler, is that anywhere in statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, yes.
Could you reference that statute for me?
I'm sure Dr. Cadigan knows her numbers. But it exists, and they are prepared for this. Aren't they?
Dr. Cadigan, do you exist?
I hate to be in the position, Mr. Chair, to contradict a representative, but the creation of the State Office of Early Learning was created through administration changes, Representative Moran. The Office of
Franzen.
Excuse me. Excuse me, it's light. So the Office of Early Learning is really a cost-effective and innovative management structure that helps align the public resources in childcare and public resources in the early learning programs so that they're best working together to avoid duplication and to make sure that we're using taxpayers' money wisely. It does not exist in statute.
Thank you.
Sandy Peterson's bill. Never did? Mm. There we go.
Representative Francis.
And I just have a few questions, Mr. Chair.
So members, you don't... just 1 second. I know people are interested in this, but in deadlines week, we're going to have to set an hour time limit on it. So just this. We start at 6:02 on this bill.
So we can go until 7:02? I can talk until...
I know you can. See if you can talk...
A little faster? We've got like 12 minutes.
See if you could beat
14
it.
Minutes. Okay, so you don't exist in statute. Is there a budget that you're working with, and what is your budget?
Dr. Cadogan.
Mr. Chair, representatives, so to be clear, this is not our bill. This is not the governor's bill. And it's not actually clear to me the extent to which resources can be given to someone such as with a sort of assistant commissioner level status. I'm not certain about the answer to that.
President Francis.
Ms. Cadogan, would you need a budget in order to run the program that Representative Winkler is?
Dr. Cadogan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, so the Office of Early Learning structure is the structure that is running the current scholarships program, mm-hmm. as well as many other state incentives. So we operate under the children's cabinet, so under the all three commissioners of health, human services, and education, with the sort of home base being in the Department of Education, and these resources would be going to the Department of Education.
Representative Franz.
Thank you. So out of the amount of money that Representative Winkler is requesting for this House file, of that amount, what would go to pay for the staff in order to help direct this program? I see that there is a director of Office of Early Learning. I assume, Ms. Cadogan, that may be you?
Dr. Cadogan.
Dr. Cadogan, I'm so sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, yes, we have staff, a team that is both in early learning services at the Department of Education, and we do administer the scholarships. We would continue to administer the scholarships. Those staff are primarily paid for by state funds currently. It's a small division in the Department of Education. We have a couple of extra staff right now because of the Race to the Top grant. We also work hand in hand. It's not just collaboration. We talk together every single day with our colleagues at the Department of Human Services. We make decisions together to make sure that public money can support family choices and quality in all kinds of programs.
Representative Franson, do you have a...
Just a question, Representative Winkler, regarding, and I know Representative Myra touched a little bit on the privacy and the confidentiality and being able to opt out. My issue with, clarification perhaps, on line 3.34 to 4.2, regarding the student identification number in order to track the child through the program and perhaps developmentally. Is there any liability for, let's see, a rated provider if she's not achieving a certain milestones with the students in the program? Is there any repercussions?
Dr. Cannon. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson,
the
Office of Early Learning will not be out tracking individual students at providers and making sure they're meeting certain benchmarks at that provider in order to continue to qualify. This has to be done as pursuant to the rating system. They're not going to be checking each child on their socio-emotional development to make sure that provider is doing what they're supposed to be doing for every single kid or that every single kid is succeeding.
Representative Francis.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, I know you kind of, you have that little mocking tone as I ask the question and you give your answer. But it is a concern that I've had providers ask of me. So if you could just perhaps rephrase your question instead of, you know, mocking my question, that would be very helpful. But that is a concern to the providers that they in turn will, if the child's not meeting the milestones and the department knows, you know, there's a tracking number for the student, I assume that the department's going to know what students are at what home. And if there's some children that are not meeting the developmental and the milestones, that they in turn could, you know, not be rated as well or be kicked off the program.
Mr. Chair, there's no mechanism in the bill to allow the department or anybody else to track on an individual student basis and go back and look at individual providers and penalize them for an individual student's performance. Was that the right tone?
Correct. We're correcting tone now, boys. Okay, there's about 7 minutes left, so I'm going to alternate between the two people I have. Let's see.
Sure.
I've got Representative. Oh, is there?
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you definitely.
But they're on the list first. They can go first.
Are we all? I can make mine in 1 minute. Mine's quick.
Since you both had like the long time, could we let her have Absolutely. One question?
Mr. Chair, are we alternating male, female, or how are we all?
Maybe by tone.
I only had two people on the list, and that was Barrett and Howe, and the way they've been going, I figured they'd run out of time.
I only got two questions.
Representative Malik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler. Would these scholarships apply for kids going to non-secular daycares or child care centers?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, secular, meaning religious faith. The answer would be yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, are there any like separation of church and state issues there that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, I can't conceive of any. We're allowing parents to make decisions on public resources just like CCAP does.
Okay. Thanks.
Representative Barrett.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I'm kind of thinking about prospective program again, how we talked about the fact that many programs currently aren't rated and still won't be rated for a couple of years. And you mentioned they can qualify temporarily as a prospective program. And then in 2016 or later, then there has to be a little bit more stringent standard. So I'm wondering, and I offer this as a friendly thought, potentially a friendly amendment, if on line 2.5, where it says after the comma, it says before the director may grant it eligibility, if maybe what we're really trying to accomplish is to maintain eligibility. Because we have the idea of a prospective program prior to 2016, so there actually would be eligible prior to then. And if to maintain would be more appropriate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, the wording is a little bit ambiguous perhaps, but there is a situation in which the program is still seeking to be a prospective, even though they didn't start before 2016, and they want to be qualified as a prospective program in 2017, and they cite some hardship for why they're not able to do that. So I think the language maybe could be fixed, and we can confer with others who drafted this to make sure that that the nomenclature works. I think the intent is pretty clear.
So you would, I think what you said is you're accepting my friendly amendment?
Representative Barrett, I don't think so.
But oh, okay.
Representative Howe.
I accept that it's friendly.
Mr. Chair, I did have one more question.
Well, I said that we'd alternate between the two of you to run out.
Well, you didn't give a limit on questions, though.
Well, yes, I did. I said I'd give one question alternating to
you. Oh, that's what you did. I thought you were alternating male-female.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr.
You
Chair.
You two could go out in the hall and fight who gets the last 6 minutes.
I don't think
or
so.
Or 4 minutes.
No, okay.
The question I've got a couple of questions, but the one question I have is on 4.1 and 4.2. It says a participating provider is liable for damages resulting in improperly release of student identification number underneath this subsection. My concern is, what happens if they're not, you know, I've been beat into on civil law now that the person that screws up gets punished. What happens if it's
not their fault that it got released. What happens if our data gets compromised here at the Office of Learning or the Office of Administration? We're going to hold the provider liable?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, that certainly is not the intention. It's a passive voice sentence, but obviously you can't be responsible for someone else's acts.
Well,
and if you'd like the better words there,
I would like to word that a little bit different. If you know, he who's at fault gets it. And I just like that redone a little bit because it sure looks like it points a finger at them no matter how it happens.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, that's very reasonable. We can accommodate that.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you.
Probably the last question.
Well, you said 7:02, Mr. Chair.
Right, but he usually uses 3 minutes just for the question at minimum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I'm wondering about how this program, early scholarships, relate to or complement the CCAP program in a household.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, it complements the CCAP program. The CCAP program doesn't necessarily cover all the expenses of a quality learning environment, and it's designed to help families who are trying to work and put kids in child care, and as their income fluctuates, the availability of the child care fluctuates. And so this is a complement and is really designed to make sure that the kid gets to stay in the program regardless of the family circumstances.
So then, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler. So how are the, where are the safeguards that allow for money not to be duplicated? Going back to Representative Preach's question earlier, which, you know, I'm stating it a different way. I want to know where the safeguards are so that money isn't being used for the same purpose over and above what the total amount of the tuition might be.
And
Representative Winkler, last question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, the calculation of the maximum amount of the scholarship is in
2.22.
Wherever you just said, yep. And yeah, the director shall annually determine the maximum scholarship amounts. This is, I mean, there is a certain amount of discretion that's vested in the director to make sure that we are not doing that. And their language in the bill also requires that they try to maximize the you know the use of the money and not concentrate in any one place. So, you know, if at some point we run into an issue there, we may have to come back and correct it. But my sense is that we can have a lot of confidence that this office and the director and staff are going to be able to make sure that the money is being used for the kids who need it, not used as a duplication for other public sources.
Just a final comment, if I could. We don't have time for a question back and forth. But
you're 48 seconds, 49 seconds over.
Oh, God. The wording is may, not shall, and so that concerns me. And I'll leave it at that.
I believe that was covered in the amendment.
Did it? Okay.
With that, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask one short question? Just one.
You're a minute and 8 seconds over.
I understand, Mr.
Really
Chair,
short.
But my question is if Representative Powell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a application gets denied, there's no procedure in here to appeal the decision of the director that I can see, and so I would like to see something in there. So if I apply for a scholarship, I get denied by the director, I'm done. I don't have an option to go elsewhere.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, I think that's substantially dealt with by the fact that you qualify. You just have to show that you're at a certain level of income. And if you qualify for various other programs that are in this bill, you're automatically in. And so I think this situation in which somebody, the director doesn't believe that somebody is as poor as they are in order to qualify for this is a fairly unlikely scenario. You know, I hadn't thought of an appeals process, but sometimes we make things overly bureaucratic if we start trying to prescribe every potential eventuality.
Okay. With that,
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Mr. Chair, I move to amend the motion to refer from education finance and re-refer to civil law. This bill makes specific reference to Chapter 13 on line 3.33, the collection and submission of private data, and makes early education providers liable for any damages resulting from data breaches. I'd like to ask for a roll call.
Mr. Chair, I accept that as it would incorporate that into my motion.
Oh, you wanted to go to civil law?
Sure. Well, we can change it. That's fine. It's reasonable. We have to do that at some point anyway, so.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
So Representative Winkler renews his motion to pass House File 1058 as amended.
Mr. Chair, just do a voice vote.
Okay. And referred to the Civil Law Committee. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Lane, you move House File 1328, and it goes to Health and Human Services Finance.
Yes, sir. Yes, that would be good, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Just go ahead and present
okay.
the bill.
Well, as you know, some child care programs accept children whose parents are eligible for the CCAP payment to help them pay child care costs. And this particular statute outlines which child care programs are eligible to receive the CCAP payment differential, a 15% higher payment for being accredited for having achieved certain standards of performance. This particular bill addresses how accreditation organizations will be recognized as upholding the standards that the departments expect. Currently, a handful of these organizations have been listed in statute. Naming private organizations in statute is not the best way to go because they may change their standards, their leadership, their mission, or even they may cease to exist, as is in the case of one of these organizations so listed. The intent of this legislation is to move away from the legislature picking organizations during one snapshot in time and move toward a merit-based system that would assess organizations based on some level of standards set by the agencies that oversee these programs.
This is from Dan.
There is a booklet here that I have that shows that it has been moved through by the Human Services Department to have a new process to approve accreditations for child care center rate differential. And the Direct Commissioner of Human Services will accept applications and annually publish a list of approved accrediting organizations. These accreditations will be reassessed every 2 years. So this will assist us in our work to recognize quality and help parents have high quality choices. With that, I turn it over to Sarah.
Go ahead and state your name.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Benscofer, and I'm the Director of Policy and Communications at the Minnesota Association for the Education of Young Children and the Minnesota School Age Care Alliance, known as MINESEAMNSACA. MINESEAMNSACA's missions are to serve and act on behalf of early childhood and school age and youth professionals in Minnesota and support programs seeking quality improvements. House File 1328 is step two in the process of changing the Child Care Assistance Program Accreditation Differential. Current law allows programs that are accredited by an accrediting organization listed in statute a 15% increase in the CCAP reimbursement rate. Last session, there was interest in changing the statute to allow for a process for accreditations to go through based on research and best practice versus simply listing the accreditations in statute. And so last session, the legislature passed and the governor signed a bill that changed the statute to require a list of standards that an accreditation must meet before being recognized for the higher rate. And the statute also required the Department of Human Services to develop an application and approval process based on these standards. And as Representative Lane showed you that on February 15th, DHS released this report and indicated further legislative action was required to implement this application and approval process. And that's the bill before you.
Two testifiers.
Two testifiers.
Yes. There's Lisa Wetzel and Joe Pickett. Go ahead, Ms. Wetzel.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Wetzel. I am the program coordinator for Kids World School Age Child Care, a program of Faribault Community Education. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about the bill. Kids World provides programming for over 400 kids annually in our community in K through 5. Before school, after school, on early dismissals, on full days, and in 12 weeks of summer. 14% of our attendees qualify for the Child Care Assistance Program. And we are a community that has over 66% of our children that are at or below the poverty level, which means they qualify for child care assistance. We're currently a program that is going through the accreditation process with the Minnesota After School Accreditation Program that's run by MNSACM and AC. And if this bill passes, it would allow us to collect the additional money that we currently do not collect, and that creates hardships for our families, and that in addition to co-pays that they have to pay, our rates are below what the market rate for child care is, or our rates are above what the child care assistance rates are, and so they have to pay those rates. And oftentimes what happens is they're not able to do that, which creates issues with the public school district and not having fees paid and trying to run in the efficiently. So if we could collect these fees through the differential, that would help. In addition, the differential gives us incentive to improve our quality and to actually seek accreditation. Oftentimes in rural areas, we're the only game in town, and so there isn't always incentive other than at the discretion of the director, which often changes. So this creates a continuous improvement plan for us that helps with turnover. It informs parents on what quality child care is. They don't often realize what that is in school age and what that means. In addition, the process encourages us to create a seamless option for children from the school day to after school care to summer care, and creates relationships with our school district that improves communication, dealing with children with special needs, administrators. It just gives validity to the program throughout the community and in the school district. So the passing of this bill encourages our program to continue quality improvement and allows us to be accessible to all. Again, in a community that has over 66% of its elementary age children at the poverty level or below, this is really important. Again, I am thankful for your time, Mr. Chairman and committee members, and greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill.
Does anybody really have a lot of questions on this, or I'm just thinking we could represent friends and all.
Okay. Actually, Mr. Chair, I am very happy with this bill. Yes, so I just want
to
say.
I just wondered if we needed to put more witnesses
on
it.
I personally don't.
Mr. Chair, no, I have questions.
Okay. I think we're ready to vote then. Is that okay? Representative Howe, did you have a question?
I just got a question.
Okay, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You interrupted me.
My question comes to the, you know, and it's not to the change. It's actually what's currently in the bill, or currently in law. But
come get me if you do.
My concern is when we look at the following accreditations, I was just wondering, and I'm concerned that the Boys and Girls Club and some of these others that provide these after-school programs and before-school programs, I don't see them listed in here. Is that because they don't go through an accreditation program to be a Boys and Girls Club, or do they got to get accredited by one of these?
Ms. Wetzel?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Howe, anyone can apply to be accredited through the MNSACM and AC, Minnesota After School Accreditation Program, and we are simply only one, or the process we're going through is only one of the accreditation processes for school-age care. So any program, whether Boys or Girls Clubs, whether 4-H, whether a church-related after-school program, they can charter school after-school programs, they all could become accredited through this process. And that's kind of, I think, what the bill is about, is that we want to leave it open and just have a system in place of standards that have to be met for accreditation programs to be part of it. So it's more about the accreditation programs than necessarily the programs who are applying for accreditation.
OK.
Okay, Representative Barron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I interrupted Representative Franson in the failed attempt to make a joke, so she was talking.
I didn't realize she had
I wanted to go on about the bill. This is an issue that I had worked on last session, and it kind of got hung up there, so I'm glad to see, or I'm hoping that there's peace in the valley now that things have gotten worked out, and it's got to be a good bill if I'm on it with Representative Winkler.
Either a really good idea or a really bad.
Okay, Representative Barrett, did you have a question?
I did not. No, I just wanted just to point out that Representative Franson had the floor.
Okay. I didn't realize she had a question. I apologize. Okay, it looks like there's no more questions. So, I forgot public testimony. Does somebody else want to really feel obliged to? Okay, can you make it?
My name is Joe Paquette. I own two private child care centers, one in Maple Grove, one in Brooklyn Park, the pay through the nose area. I was here to testify on behalf and support of this bill. It's actually a bill that I worked with the legislature on last session to get passed through. And we also had a free market perspective on this, that this was going to kind of level the playing field, because previously there was accrediting bodies that were encapsulated in the statute, and when we tried to get our accreditation that we're under recognized, we were running into problems that the statute needed to be changed. So we were advocating for a process that looked at the accrediting bodies to make sure that they were recognized as high quality and that it was a level playing field for all accrediting bodies. So,
Okay, thank you. Representative Lane renews her motion to pass House File 1328, and that goes to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you. So,
I can present their bills if you'd like.
Are you the author of these two?
Is going to get
questions. We're not going to do that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could we take a short recess to stretch our legs? And
okay. Do you want a 5-minute recess or something?
No. What did you say?
I thought maybe 5 minutes. Clark is just coming up from 300.
Okay. 5 minutes.
Okay.
Something.
That's fine.
Warm in here.
Okay. Yes, it is warm.
Is there any air conditioning or fan that we can turn on?
I don't think so. We've had the door open. Maybe somebody could open that door if it's not too noisy out there. There's no fan, unfortunately. You think this is bad, Representative Meyer? Wait till
I'm gonna have the page ask Travis if it's
late in May.
Late in May.
Jody,
yeah, you get sometimes.
I'm optimistic we'll get done early.
Conference committees. Oh, you're I'm sorry. Okay, the committee is recessed until, let's say, 7:25.
I'm in recess.
We would not have proceeded.
Should be in the hallway. He was on his phone.
Or 300 North. Mustafa.
300 North.
So who is presenting? She was in line.
No, you can't do that.
This is the bill that we
protect the territory or something.
What?
Are you signed to protect the
territory? Yeah, I guess I'll kind of hang out and just stretch my legs.
I think you might as well.
Fresh air within 6 feet of the door.
Because when we get to his, you'll be. Yeah. Oh, no.
No, because we're taking out the article that people are concerned about.
Oh, okay. I have no idea what they're concerned about, but I think they're going to probably ask a lot of questions. It sounded from when I asked them before.
Well,
you asked if there were any two bills.
The word controversial.
I think you were asking if any that would quickly move and
right.
Not worry about a 5-5
right,
tie.
Right, exactly. That was what I was worried about.
Well, Jody won 16. Harry succeeded in excising anything good out of my bill.
He's not out there, so I'm going to
have to go shooting at him. Okay.
I'm shooting at that. Yeah, because we're taking off the entire
article. That's why. Did you even see that I took out section like 6 out of my 12?
No, I do even take out section 6. I think there are some other areas of the bill that we're still concerned for some members.
Oh, whichever.
I thought it was
one of the chapters.
Just taking out section 6 or something.
No, I think that was the initial red flag, but there are still a couple other areas of concern. Some of the members have felt more comfortable getting a.
We took a break because we were
interested.
Yeah,
I was up in
your
guys'
office. Can't be up there. Oh, yeah. And if you actually want to anyway,
well,
so can you?
I think it's fair to say.
Hi. How are you?
Wait, congratulations. So if you could show up.
I'd be happy to great shots.
Would you mind?
Sure.
Thanks. You can go to his office.
Yes. Right here.
Yeah, we're just. Yeah, I'm helping watch.
So this is a big short section. From Article 5.
So what amendments are you offering? Because I have
I don't even know.
Article 5 is the background.
I think I'm doing
I'm not doing any Mary France on that.
The amendments are the function and deleting Section 8.
That's yeah. Section well, there's this. Steps. There's this one.
Right.
Delete Section 8
in Article 5. Right.
There's this amendment.
That is the bleach one, which isn't anything to do with background studies.
But that's Mary's, and she likes.
Well, this is Representative Franson's amendment.
And then we're not doing any of the amendments that I know of, unless Joe was going to do with his.
I understood that.
Yeah. We're not doing the other one. There's one about your future case. We're not doing that.
Conditional license that became constitutional.
Yeah, we're not doing that. Because it's
already right.
Provide technical assistance. That one I'm not. What, Aaron? Yes.
Okay.
It is.
Okay. So it would be
those. But so this is the only author's amendment. Everything else is somebody else's amendment.
Yes.
Okay.
And the one that was right. We're not doing the other one. Because
we're not.
Yeah.
Maybe had that argument one time. What article was that one?
That was in Article 5.
I
just want you to be in
there.
I just want you to be in there. Well, no, but I'd like you to just know
the
policy. The substance. Never mind the amendments, but now it's just like Article 5.
Article 5?
Real quick.
Sure.
Yeah. So maybe just look at this copy and tell them what everything is.
All right. Which is, you know, I think for section by section, I'm trying to copy some of them.
Right.
And so, okay, so I'm going to section 1 is something that providers have asked for to change the timeline from the study. Yeah, it's the entire narrative here. Changes. Right now there's 90 days absent. And that changes it to, let's see where it is. It's a long
story.
So 90 days has been changed to 120 days to initiate the study. It's in multiple places. This is the background study under NET study, which is our system. So the customer providers told us that.
As it goes, okay.
And so last year, last session, 120 was discussed. You know, here was discussed, 90 was discussed.
I don't mean to be rude, but I'm also dealing with text messages from members and other committees. Well, let's kind of move on to another section.
And most of this is clarifying. Do you want each section or highlight?
Well, I mean, I guess an area of new study required for a change.
Right. When they undergo a legal change.
What's paragraph C? What's this one?
Okay. Well, paragraph C here is part of we dissolve by individuals and notify them if they're not set aside, they have due process rights, okay? And so if they were not, we do an initial risk of harm, either immediately removed or continuing assistance. If they were not originally ordered, they're and they have a hearing, right? Then,
I had them beforehand when we came in, so it actually worked out really well.
and they are either ordered immediately no supervision needed, and then they have a due process right to request for consideration. If after consideration is set aside, and they then have a hearing right, there's two levels of due process, and they were not previously ordered
okay.
Hey, man.
Hello.
Keep up the good fight.
Section 8 is out and there's nothing right. going in.
Okay. Hey, I expect a letter, too, if something bad happens.
Yeah. There's a little call at the end of downstairs.
Do I get to go down there?
I prefer this one to the university.
There's 200.
All right. Here?
If they're done with it, then come back up with
545. That's a lot. Yeah. Sweating it out.
Turn on the TV.
Turn the lights off. Section 9 to 10 are a little bit more than
that.
It's hot. Yeah.
And what they're doing.
I'm going to take my coat off.
No.
So what's the plan?
I'm going to roll up my sleeves too. We're going to get to work here. We're going to get to work.
Let's get to work.
I have a clue.
Yeah. Pam, is it okay to start? This is one of the non-controversial.
What is his name?
Clark. There's two, but both of them are non-controversial. So, somebody want okay. Meeting will come back to order after recess, and we will next take up House File 703. Does somebody want to move Representative Clark's bill?
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 1190-703. I'm sorry, be recommended to pass and be referred to the committee on
Health and Human Services. Fine.
Well said.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Winkler moves your bill. Representative Clark, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is with you today because in December I got a call from some. Members of the child care community who said there is a law that we found out about that is set to take effect on January 1st of 2013, and it would shut down our child care facilities in the Somali community and in other New American communities where there's large families. And so we looked into it and started talking with people at the Department of Human Services and found out that, indeed, there had been a bill that not hardly any of us knew about. I can say I knew nothing about it, and many child care providers did not know about it either, that said something like there cannot be more than 50% of the children in a child care facility who have a family member who is working in that child care facility or someone who's living in the same house even, I guess. And so that the situation is that it doesn't work very well for large families to be able to deal with that. And I brought with me today some of the members of the New American
Business Association.
Yes, okay. Child Care New American
Business Association,
excuse me, who would deal with a number of services, including family child care centers. This is for centers, not family home health, not family child care in homes. And what happens, and I think Mr. Jama can talk to you, Abderzak Nama, or my witness here, can talk to you a little bit about that. We had numerous meetings to talk about how can we address this issue because it's culturally very difficult for large families who may have maybe several preschoolers in a child care center and then maybe more after-school kids. So you maybe have like 5, 6, 7, 8 kids from a family. One family in a child care center, and if there's a relative or somebody working there, that would immediately break the 50% number just from several families. So that was revealing to me, and Senator Hayden and I met with the people from this association and with the commissioner's representatives and with the commissioner of human services as well. And what resulted was a recommendation that the implementation of that law be delayed. And she specifically recommended that be delayed, as is indicated in this bill, to July 1st, 2014, so that they could figure out how do you culturally address this issue when you have very large families. They hadn't thought about that when this particular provision was added the year before in 2012. In addition, the commissioner said, you know, we probably should have done a better job of providing outreach and information on this to the families that would have been affected. And so that's the second section of this bill. The first section is just the delay of the date of implementation. The second section is to do outreach and training assistance on this and other technical issues related to making sure that some of our new Americans understand how the child care assistance works, what the rules and requirements are. So that's what this bill does. This language came to us from the commissioner, both of those sections, and I guess I'd ask our witness here maybe to give a little more information, and then we'll be
done. Thank you, Mr. Jamla. Do you want to? You can be fairly brief.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanking officers here, the ministers, committees. It's a great honor to testify in front of you about this bill, HF703, which we support. I'm representing New American Business Association, which constitute about 120 businesses, both in child care, home health care, transportation, and interpretation service. We believe that this bill will make us possible to do the job that we are accredited for by the DHS, Human Service, which we meet all the requirements of the license. And to tell you the background of this business, after we have seen that our children, immigrants' children, have been homebounded and never be attending a preschool or other child care centers due to mistrust or cultural difference, we decided to create our ethnic daycare centers, which fulfill all the license requirements by the DHS and the federal. And we found that our children, they develop skills in understanding the school setting that they never had before, like sharing, developing cognitive skills. And we figured out that in that capacity, our kids developed a high standard in school settings. For example, a report made by Cynthia Ball from Seattle Public Schools, and in code it says 76% of Minneapolis school children coming from homes where Somali is spoken test kindergarten grade, not far behind 82% of English-speaking kids who are kindergarten ready and better than some of the other groups. And I think that you have in that report in your folder. Second, we have created so many jobs for so many disadvantaged families who are not supposed to get jobs before, or have no history of work history. And we turn them from poverty cycle into a self-sufficiency and tax-paying contributors in the mainstream and American society. So therefore, we recommend that this industry, which is really we just entered into a main industry of childcare business, to be sustained and accepted this bill. For the training part or the outreach, there is a gap of misculture or cultural gap between the DHS and the ethnic daycare centers. And this outreach and training capacity building will help to bring this gap, to narrow this gap as well as possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anybody with questions of Mr. Jama? Okay, is there anybody that wants to testify on this bill? Representative Winkler renews his motion to pass.
Mr. Chair,
oh, I'm sorry.
May I ask a question about
sure.
Senate Clark?
Sure. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say Mr. Jama? Sorry.
Yes, you did.
I meant any questions. Sorry.
All right.
Okay, sure, yes. Representative Meyer, of course.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, would you please re-explain what is happening with Section 1 again and the impact?
Representative Clark.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 1 just delays the effective date of enforcement of the law that was passed in 2012.
And
Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, could you explain again why that's needed?
Representative Clark.
Yes, because the effective date was January 1st of 2013. And so when it was brought to me by the individuals who said, we do not know how in the world we could comply with this without closing down some of our facilities because we have large families and who are in these daycare centers. And then when we talked with the department, immediately we began this discussion right away, and then we had some meetings here for over the next, 4 to 6 weeks, and the department recommended this date. They said, let's take 18 months and study how we can make more culturally appropriate the regulations we have for our child care centers.
Thank you for clarifying. Meyer.
Yes, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear before.
This is Representative Hall. Did you have a question?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question stems to, there's a large population of Somalis up in St. Cloud area. How many, as far as geographically goes, how far does this reach out? Is it just a metro area deal? Can you explain a little bit as far as where we're looking at and the outreach and where this all is going to impact?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hall, that's a very good question. This is a statewide application, and it's not just limited to the Somali community. It's any large ethnic community and large families. And so there's Latinos, I think, that probably would be affected by this. The Somali community is who discovered and brought it to my attention and to the commissioner's attention. So it's statewide, and if you have folks in your area who need that kind of outreach, we want to make sure they get it.
So Representative Winkler renews his motion to pass House File 703 and refer it to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Anybody
want to move House File 1192?
I'm so moved.
Representative Moran moves House File 1192. Go ahead, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd ask several. Idol Abdul to join me here at the table.
Representative Clark, well,
I'll tell
why
you
don't
what
you start, and
I'll
we'll
start it. Yes.
Probably take about two short testifiers.
Okay, that's fine. And Mr. Chairman, I want to tell you that there were a couple of amendments that will not be introduced in this committee because they didn't make the 24-hour rule, but they will be, unless you want to do them. But they will otherwise go to the finance committee. And I, if you want me to share those with the committee, I'd be glad to do it.
We don't even have them.
No, I know. I have them here.
Mr. Chair, that would be fine.
Is that okay?
Okay. Do you want me to pass them? Have them passed out?
Yes.
Okay. Do we have someone to pass them out?
She's doing everything tonight.
Okay.
She's the page.
Yeah, okay. That's fine.
Okay, Representative Clark, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm really pleased to bring this bill before you as well. And this specifically does come from some work with the Somali community that I've been privileged to do for a number of years. Let me just say that right now we know, and there have been some information in the last few years, that there's a high incidence of autism in the Somali community. Right now there's a prevalence study that's being done, funded by federal dollars, to actually determine what that prevalence is. So we don't know for sure exactly what it is, but it appears that it's higher, and we want to get at that. And I have to say that my witness here is one of the people who actually helped bring federal dollars to Minnesota by her personal intervention in Washington, and I'm very pleased about that. So what you have before you today is a bill that has several parts. One of them is dealing with making sure that people have information about the services that are available. And that's section one, the services that are available to parents of children with autism. This is any part of the state. Again, this is not just the Somali community, but there's a lack of some information, and so this would prescribe how to make that information more available. The second part of it, section two, is substantial. This is one of the reasons it needs to go to the Human Services Finance Committee, because we're saying that children who are in medical assistance should have the same opportunity for some of the kinds of services that children who are covered by health insurance, I think, under some other legislation that's being covered. And the section three, I just want to tell you, that's one of the amendments that you have. Right now, I guess what I would do is strike that language, and we have the amendment I think you have in your hand, one of them, I think it's numbered
285.
We will replace it with that in the next committee. And let's see. And then the last section deals with making sure that the autism service providers, again, have some training in culturally specific information that they need in order to really serve our communities who right now are really having some difficulties and perhaps disproportionate incidents. That's something we don't 100% know. I guess the other amendment you have, A1, I should have mentioned, we changed some of the wording on that first section, page 1, line 5, to insert, to make sure that we have individuals who are trained in mental health professionals more than just psychologists and MDs. And we're using on page 2, line 1, we're removing the language there that says National Institute of Mental Health and Disease, instead substituting the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is a more appropriate reference for understanding how this work should be done. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that's the language of the amendment. We're not putting that on, as I understand, here at your request, but we did want you to know about it, and if we could have a little testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Meyer, do you think it's okay to put those
on?
Okay, thank you. Why don't we do that then?
Okay. Somebody would move those, that would be
great. If nobody objects, we'll go ahead and put those on. Then Representative Moran moves the 285 amendment.
I just got it's all right to move them. I just got one question on it once we get into it. That's fine.
Is that okay to go ahead and move it? Okay. Then all in favor of Representative Moran's motion to put the bill in the way the author wants it, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. And is the other one okay? Okay. Then Representative Moran moves the A1 amendment to put it in the shape that the author would request. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only question I have is on the A1 amendment, when we put on there the or other mental health professionals, could you elaborate on who those other, what other mental health professionals we're looking at adding?
Sure. I'll tell you what I know, and perhaps we could ask our witnesses to say a little bit more, but we can be talking about clinical psychologists, psychiatrists, other mental health workers, maybe even psychiatric social workers. We're just not trying to spell it out exactly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's my concern, is that you know, I'd kind of like it to be a little bit more narrow, because it's a little vague on who those mental health professionals could be. It'd be even if we could just have a definition of mental health professionals someplace to tighten that up a little bit.
Okay.
Thank you.
Clark, can you take care of that?
I'm happy to do that by the time it gets to the next committee. Okay. Thank you. And I'll make sure that you get that information, Representative Powell.
Does anybody need further testimony on this bill?
I have a question.
Okay. Representative Franzen.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On the A13 amendment? You adopted that one.
13?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
285,
sorry, A13-0285. On line 1.5, prevention of autism in cultural communities, why can't we address issues of prevention of autism in all communities in Minnesota? Because autism does affect, I do understand that there's portions that it affects more, but autism does affect all families, all kinds of communities in
Representative
Minnesota.
Clark.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Yes, cultural communities is not limited. I mean, it is all. But I think what we want to know is if there's any differentiation at some point, and if there needs to be a special addressing of, you know, language barriers or other cultural barriers. But yes, it's all cultures. It's all cultures. That's what it says there. I had started out thinking maybe we needed to look at what we know about some of the disproportionate in certain communities of color. This is broader. This, we put it back to cultural communities.
I'd like to work on this issue with you offline.
Sure.
If
that's okay, that's fine. Thanks. Okay. And Mr. Chairman, if we could have a little bit of testimony anyway.
Okay, very short, because I'd like to give the committee a break before we
okay.
have to go back.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. Good afternoon or good evening, I guess. My name is Aidil Abdul. I have a son with autism. He's 10, and I am originally from Somalia. He was born here in Minnesota. And in 2009, Minnesota Department of Health did a prevalence administrative study in Minneapolis preschool and found that Somali children, born, or American children, I should say, born to Somali parents of 3 and 4 year olds, which is this study that you have.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. This that you have under previous administration, they found that their autism was higher up to 7 times in preschools. Mm-hmm. And so after that study, I worked hard, and I guess I bothered a lot. And so I went to the federal government, and we were able to get $400,000 from CDC, NIH, NIMH, NIEH, and Office of Minority Health, a total of $400,000. And as a result of that study, it's going on at the University of Minnesota in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Health and CDCs as a technical assistance. And so what that study is going to tell us, it sort of answered what previous Commissioner Dr. Sandy McNam did, the next steps, if you see. Now, then the question comes, regardless, that the U.S. says it's 1 in 88. And if you look at these states that I've given you, these are what is called the ADAM surveillance, so the Autism Developmental Disabilities Monitoring System. That's where we get the 1 in 88. So Minnesota is not part of it because we never applied. In Utah, it's 1 in 47. In Alabama, it's 1 in over 200. So that means the 1 in 88 is sort of a medium. But we don't have a surveillance system. As you can see, we don't have the SEED study. On the next graph, I try to give you all the states that have autism going on. And Minnesota is just really not one of them. We don't have anything going on in terms of research. So we support this wholeheartedly because we want to make sure that Minnesota is one of the best health departments in the country. I don't say a lot of good things about MDH, but in this case, they are really one of the good ones epidemiologically. But I think when it comes to autism, there seems to be a sleeping of the wheel. And so I have some parents here, some of whom have 2 or 3 children with autism. And their children are as American as apple pie, right? So they're not going to go back to Somalia. They are here. They will be a burden to society if we don't do something about it, if we don't try to figure out what's happening. You are right, Professor Franson. I support a lot of the stuff that you've said, that autism is affecting everybody. But sometimes certain diseases and certain conditions affect certain ethnicities, and I think the Minnesota Department of Health and the state of Minnesota has a gold mine opportunity to take this as an opportunity and to study it so that, who knows, you know, maybe we can find the cause of autism in a Somali kid and the cure. And imagine how much less you would have to fund in services, in DHS, in health department. Imagine that. I think it's a really awesome step, and I really want to commend you. And I know sometimes they say James Brown is the hardest working person in show business. I really think Kristen Clark is the hardest working legislator in Minnesota. She multitasks like I've never seen, and I applaud you for doing this. And we do want to get to the bottom of it. I think Minnesota needs to apply the surveillance. They need to apply this autism grant for state planning, and they need to have research, not just research, but services and resources that are culturally responsive. Mm-hmm. And so that now we are new immigrants, as you saw the other folks. But all of you, America is a nation of immigrants, right? So all of your grandparents or great-grandparents came from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think ignoring the culture differences will be catastrophe later on financially. And I just want to add that I'm also a member of the Minnesota Autism Task Force, nominated by Speaker Zellers. And so we're working on that, and I'm also a member of the IAC, which is the Federal Advisory Council, nominated by Secretary Sebelius. And so in the U.S., there's a lot going on. In Minnesota, not so much. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may we hear from a couple of the parents that have come?
If you want, if the committee wants to. Representative Moran, do you have a question?
I have a question, and my question was, how many families in Somalia have autism? How many of the children in Somalia have autism? Is there a high number?
And so in Somalia, I would have to say the only thing that we're really good at is the ability to talk. We are called an oral society, right? So that means we know how to communicate verbally, as you might be able to tell. But what autism has done is silence. So it's not hitting us on the Asperger side where children have social issues. And so I don't remember anybody not talking at all. We had mental illness, we had Down syndrome, we had mental health conditions. But what this has done is silence. It's sort of like, you know, piano players losing fingers, singers losing voice, basketball players losing their legs. It hit us in the core, which is why I really think our state has to take an opportunity and study this, figure out what's going on. If I can interpret, she has 7 children. Somalis have kids like Catholics. Okay, what should I want to add about?
My name is Hakima Dini.
Her name's Hakima Dini, and she has 7 kids, and she has 2 boys with autism, and never heard of the services, none of the ABA, early intervention, none of the waivers until the oldest kid was 20, mm-hmm. and the younger is 14.
Can you move the mic over a little? I mean, it has to pick up on the recordings.
Okay. And I know her story a little bit, and her husband actually had heart attack.
Three times,
due to the stress of autism. Mm-hmm. And so there goes our issue. We have to address this. Is there anything that you want to
know? Check the gonia. Ah, and then the baran.
She says we want a cause and a cure and a prevention. This is just one family. We've got families that have gotten strokes due to the stress, bipolar, mental health conditions. We have mothers and fathers in hospitals due to the stress of having 2, 3, 4 on the spectrum. And so I really urge you to look at this as a public health crisis, and let's do something. Minnesota, let's set an example for autism.
Okay, thank you. And I think, any more questions? Representative Moran then renews her. Did anybody want to speak on it from? Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maggie Diebel. I'm the director of the Community and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. I thought someone was motioning to me. Forgive me. I just wanted to clarify something that was said earlier. Ms. Abdul referenced the study that the Department of Health did in 2008 in response to concerns expressed on the part of the community about their having seen many more of their kids, Somali kids, in Minneapolis public school special education programs for 3- and 4-year-olds than kids of other ethnicities. We did undertake a study to look at that. And so we looked at data. This is administrative prevalence data, and that means kids who are participating in special education programs. So we did look at that over the a period of 3 years. Indeed, we saw that in the first year of the study, there were proportionally many more Somali kids in those programs as compared to other kids. We did note that difference diminished over the course of the 3 years. We also noted that there were many fewer Asian and American Indian kids in those classrooms than we would expect based on the estimates by CDC of prevalence across communities. So I just want to clarify that we did not establish that there was a higher prevalence rate among the Somali population. It did raise questions whether there is a higher rate, whether kids were accessing the programs at a higher rate than other kids were. We might think that perhaps the Hmong kids weren't, the Asian kids weren't represented in those Minneapolis special education programs because they live in St. Paul. We only looked at Minneapolis. So I guess what I want to say is it did raise a lot of questions. And so as a result, Ms. Abdul was very successful in lobbying at the national level to bring funding into the state. It came to the University of Minnesota. They are in the process of undertaking a prevalence study in Minneapolis to determine whether there is indeed a higher prevalence rate in the Somali community as compared to other communities. So I just wanted you to have that information. When it was communicated there is a higher prevalence rate, that is what the University of Minnesota is now undertaking to determine whether there is or not. Thank
now,
you.
Now the chair has a question from what you raised. You said that there was, you didn't study the Hmong because there was, they live in St. Paul.
I was just giving an example of perhaps why there was a lower, there were fewer kids in those classes than one might expect. It just raised questions about maybe they weren't accessing those Minneapolis public school programs at the same rate that Somali kids were or other kids were. It just raised some questions about why that situation might be.
I'm sorry, but I believe there's 9,000 Hmong on the north side just alone.
Oh, I apologize.
I think there's actually more Hmong living in Hennepin County than in Ramsey County.
Mr. Chair and committee, I stand corrected.
Okay.
If I could just finally say, I really appreciate the committee looking at this and the study that will be done, I think by July, perhaps by the beginning of the next fiscal year, we'll address this issue of prevalence. And so then we'll have something to look at for the design of the study that's in that amendment. So.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Now we are going to go ahead. Representative Moran renews her motion to pass House File 1192 as amended and be referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Next we'll take up 1293 because we actually have her, she's been in and out of the room running out of that.
Oh, sure. What are
we doing
now?
All 39.
Sorry.
Mr. Muller, do you have a motion?
Yes. I would move House File 1293, and it goes to the General Register.
Okay, Mr. Representative Mullery has moved his bill. Please go ahead. You have an amendment?
Yes, I have to move A1 amendment.
Put it in the shape the author wants. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Members, this is actually important. I remember years ago being over in the Supreme Court building meeting with some juvenile judges, Supreme Court Justice Paul Anderson, and some other Juvenile Justice Coalition people, and finding out that the CHIPS system doesn't talk to the delinquency system, for instance, and neither one talks to the school system. And so I made the suggestion at that time that they start working together on children, because when a youth is in the delinquency system, there's probably some other things going on maybe in their life, and that we should work on everything. And Justice Anderson thought it was great, but the juvenile justices thought it, or judges thought it didn't make any sense. Then I'm about a year and a half ago, I was at a presentation with one of those same juvenile justices saying that there was this fantastic new idea out of Georgetown where you took CHIPS cases and merged them with delinquency cases, and they call it crossover now. You know, that's the, you get crossover trainer shoes, you get crossover cars. When it was Joe Mullery's idea, she thought it was terrible, but when it was Georgetown University, it was fantastic.
Mr. Chair, you are the chair here, so we think your ideas are good.
So basically, as you heard earlier at various times through the presentations we've had this year in this committee, there's a whole lot of agencies and different levels of government that aren't working together on that. And National Alliance on Mental Illness has been one of the ones bringing up the complete problems with the fact that they aren't working together. There's the reason I went to the speaker to create this committee was to try to break down silos, and that's what some of the groups such as NAMI have been trying to get done. And so we're trying to do this on the whole issue of youth and help them when they first, before they get into trouble, but especially then, rather than the old system, and start working together in this. And so Ms. Abderholden has been working on this for years, and she basically jumped, the old phrase, jumped at the chance to take this on and try to help coordinate that and come back with a report on how we can do that in the future. So Ms. Abderholden.
You know the routine.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden with NAMI Minnesota. And as Representative Mullery said, it's, you know, no surprise to anyone that children involved in the juvenile justice system are also involved in other systems too: child welfare, special education, mental health, substance use disorder, and so on. Just to give you some statistics, 70% of youth in the juvenile justice system have at least one diagnosable mental health disorder. 61% have co-occurring substance use and mental health disorder. About 90% have had trauma exposure, and at least half meet the criteria for PTSD. By junior high, over half of the kids in one study who were adjudicated delinquent were delayed in all academic areas, etc. So you can see when we our systems don't work together, and they really have those silos, what we find is that kids don't do well at all. Some states have taken some steps to really begin to address this area, and I think in the last decade as well, we've learned a lot more about adolescent brain development, you know, frankly, sometimes the lack of it in certain areas. I've had teenagers, so I kind of know that piece. But what we want to make sure is that we reduce some of those symptoms that really bring kids into contact, so things like impulsivity, risky behavior, anger, irritability, over-response to situations, paranoia, the flight, flight, or freeze syndrome, and low levels of cognitive skills. What we'd like to do, and what we've seen, there are some jurisdictions, excuse me, in Minnesota, where they have collaborated. Hennepin, Carver, Stearns, Kandy, Yohai, and Olmsted have actually been implementing the crossover youth model, where we do bring everyone together to try to figure it out. And what they've seen through those initiatives are that fewer kids are involved in multiple systems, there's fewer out-of-home placements, lower recidivism, and lower disproportionate minority contact with the juvenile justice system. We think it's an opportunity, again, to bring everyone together. I think many of you know NAMI has a history of trying to bring different parties together to create solutions to some pretty major problems, and we're happy to do this again.
Discussion. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this comes from my military background where I struggle here, but on line 2.4 you use, and you used it in your description of the deal, and it's probably because I'm not familiar with all the acronyms here, but when you use CHIPS, nowhere in here does it tell me what CHIPS stands for. So it would be nice if you had all these other ones with NAMI, if you could spell that out for me, and so other people could know what CHIPS mean if they read the bill and aren't familiar with it, but please tell me what CHIPS stands for.
Representative Mullery.
Representative Howe, it's Children in Need of Protective Services. Children in Need of Protective Services.
That doesn't make...
Representative Powell.
Protection or services.
Oh, I get it. Okay, got it.
Ask in Hennepin, they have a whole department.
Further discussion? Anyone in the audience need to testify? Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Mullery or Ms. Abderholden, I was just wondering if you're going to be studying, say that a juvenile is adjudicated delinquent and sent to one of our juvenile delinquency centers, are you going to be studying whether or not the length of time that they're sentenced to serve is appropriate for the crime they were convicted of, or if it ends up having a negative effect on them because maybe they're there too long based on their youth?
Representative Mullery.
First, I have a question. You used a real technical term, sentence to serve. Do you, because you were talking about it seemed to be an incarceration. Sentence to serve is a community thing, so...
I don't think I used that term. If I did, I didn't mean to. I'm sorry, okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Moline, why don't you restate your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mullery and Ms. Abderholden, what I was asking is if a juvenile is adjudicated delinquent and serves the time at a juvenile delinquency center, are you going to be studying whether or not the time that they serve at that juvenile delinquency center is appropriate for the crime that they committed, or if...
Representative Moline, I can assure you that they better study that because that's been a huge push of mine for several years to get into that, because we are actually there. I've been involved with NCSL for about 7 years with their program on youth development, which is more the non-IQ part of the brain development, and there's a lot of studies that show that our present system of locking up youth, especially when they first get into the system. Now, we've got some youth in Minneapolis that are too dangerous to be out, but most youth, especially at the beginning, there's a lot of indication we need to provide them with a lot of services and other things. Ms. Abderholden's mental health is extremely important for these. That's why I want to bring CHIPS in there, because they should be involved with the youth a lot more. Why does the delinquency system not look at the family and the peers and decide what's going on with them? How can we save that youth and get them to be a good part of the community? That's a major reason why I did this. So I don't think I have to over, because that's what they've been about too.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I have two, I guess I don't even know what to call them, but juvenile corrections facilities in my district. One of them is run by a nonprofit that's based on the East Coast, and the other one is run by the state. And we hear all kinds of different things in the community all the time about the effectiveness of those programs, but I have a lot of really deep concerns about the kids that are at those facilities, so I appreciate you bringing this forward.
Thank you. I don't know anything about up there, but I do know what's going on here, and it needs a lot of work. Although, like Ms. Abderholden said, we are finally just, I think there's been, by now there's probably 20 youth in that crossover program in Hennepin. So we got a long way to go, but these things are starting. And Hennepin no longer uses that. They used to send a huge amount, I think it's called Glen Haven in Pennsylvania, and they no longer do that.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 1293 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion prevails.
Hey, Dean.
but if it's going to be a new statute, you got to help me.
That's okay.
Representative Dean. The chair will move House File 1471 to pass and be referred to State Government Finance. I see Mr. Jones. Sorry, don't look. That's okay. Representative Dean, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Bill 1471 looks at to provide funding for a pilot project to coordinate community violent prevention programs for the African-American children. If you look at some of the findings, we know that children who witness homicide out in the community often experience post-traumatic stress and other types of factors that impact them greatly. We also know that oftentimes community institutions lack the skills necessary to recognize that trauma on these children and provide the psychological first aid that is much needed. And because these children lack that opportunity, they don't learn the appropriate problem-solving techniques and often use violence as a primary problem-solving method to resolve their issues in personal conflicts. So this is proposing funding goes to the Council on Black Minnesotans so that they can plan, design, and implement what we're calling the Martin Luther King Nonviolent Institutional Child Development Pilot Project. It would provide funding to multi-institutional, interdisciplinary, which I guess is now called crossover, community violence prevention programs. And, you know, we would like you to support this. We do have an appropriation of $360,000 in fiscal year 2014 and $350,000 in fiscal year 2015. Mr. Jones is with me, but I'd like to give him just a couple minutes. I know you have trouble with a couple minutes sometimes.
Representative Dean knowing Mr. Jones.
Yeah. Well, I've got the mic, so. Yeah. And then I'm going to turn it over to Felix James, who is retired St. Paul school counselor,
for a few comments. And then we'll leave a few minutes for questions. We'll try to be brief because I know that all of us want to get a cup of water before we head back to
work. Right. And Representative Dean, I'll vote for your bill if you take out the word crossover.
it's not included in that.
Oh, okay.
It's just my reference.
Go ahead, Mike.
Mr. Chair.
You have to state your name first.
My name is Michael Jones. I'm a person that's been advocating for programs to help children impacted by homicide and violence since 1990. I am with a group of agencies that began this back in 1990 when Minneapolis had a spike in homicides. And then 6 years later, as Representative Richard Jefferson's intern, I drafted this bill. It was funded for...
There was a program before...
Yes, to the council, yes. It went from 1996 to 2003. I believe that there was a sea change in government, and that program was one of those that got drowned. This program is very important. In Minnesota, as well as in the rest of the nation, African Americans, youth, are murdered. It's the number one cause of death. Last year, Chicago had 500 homicides, 500 plus homicides, and it didn't even make the news. Detroit, similarly situated, had just as many. Minneapolis is a place where we get a lot of people who move here from other cities and so on, and our homicide rates are going up and up in our community. We don't have any programs that intervene across the institutional board to assist these children impacted by this. Not in the foster homes, not in delinquency services, not in the schools. And in fact, in 1990, when I first got involved with this, while we were looking at how schools were responding to a youth death. If the child died of suicide, there were all kinds of programs. But if the child died from homicide, there was nothing. One of the other problems that we have is that in a lot of situations involving these kids, say a kid gets murdered like 2 years ago in the summer of 2010, where, no, 2011, and the kid was shot in the leg first, went to the hospital, got treated, came home, was walking down the street where his mother lived, and was ambushed and was killed. Well, that homicide spiraled into another homicide 6 months later, where a six-year-old boy sitting on his couch was killed by two individuals retaliating for that other child's death. In a lot of situations, these kids are going to a school where a member of their family gets murdered, and their relatives could be sitting in the same classroom with the victim's, with the perpetrator's family, the victim's. And we don't have communication ability to have it where the law enforcement could say who the person of interest is, so that teachers and so on could develop some kind of safety protocols for these kids. As you know, and I got to wrap it up, as you know, it can take a long time between when the cops know someone did it and they have enough evidence to bring a case. And in a lot of situations involving African-American homicides, those cases don't come to court. And then these kids start building ideas of, I got to get even, I got to solve this myself. This is why this program is important.
Please state your name.
Felix James, former counselor of St. Paul Public Schools, retired. Through the public school system, we see everything firsthand. We see the results of on both sides, the victim and the families. We see the best friends. Usually when there's a trauma situation at a school, we have a trauma team set up, and we visit that school. Trauma teachers volunteer to go to another school and deal with a lot of the emotional stuff that goes along with the homicides and so forth and death. But a lot of times we don't know about the people who are affected by the shooting or whatever. It's just something we just don't know. We find out 2 days later, 3 days later, through a friend, one-on-one counseling, maybe somebody will mention it. Kids don't come to school a lot of times wearing their emotions on their shoulders. Sometimes they do. We get the ones that are, we understand what's happening when it's a little fire, but we miss the other stuff. This program, we hope to put together, is designed to implement a situation in which triggers go off. That is, if the fire is lit somewhere, it could come from the juvenile system, it can be initiated by the school. Then a lot of things will happen automatically throughout an interdisciplinary way throughout the system, so that the attention can be brought to bear basically from a psychological perspective, family systems that we worry about. It affects learning. We want to talk with kids to read. A lot of schools are pressure on students to learn how to read, but sometimes when you listen to them talk to you, you hear all the other background noise, and you say, how can reading plow through that? Something professional and in an interdisciplinary way needs to happen at that particular point in time in a child's life. A lot of times we ignore it. So the family doesn't get the attention they need. The health situation, we aren't sure about nutrition sometimes. We're not even sure about the learning. What's really affecting the learning? What's affecting the whole apparatus, the whole person. So this program, we hope, will bring bring it together so that we can all address those needs simultaneously.
Before going on, Representative Meyer caught a problem with this, and I didn't have a chance to read it, but Representative Meyer is correct. We don't do findings in bills here, in law. And so, Representative Meyer, do you want to make your motion?
Mr. Chair, I would.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, our committee hasn't accepted findings.
to be put in statute, and so my motion is that we would delete Section 1 of House File 1471.
Section 1 of 14. Anybody want to discuss that? Representative Dinas, are you? That's what we do.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Then all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Does anybody else want to testify? Feel a horrible need to testify on this? Okay. Representative Warren, do you want to testify?
No, I don't want to testify. But we have had extensive individuals come in with expertise around stressors and traumas that impacts children's lives and the brain development. And we also have a long history of disparities within our criminal justice system and our educational system, which also comes back to those impacts around stressors and traumas that impacts kids' lives. And so, you know, when there is a murder or when there is violence in a home and kids are not getting the services they need to become functioning adults or young people to think that process through, it really impacts their behavior. So I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward and creating an opportunity for kids of African descent to get the support, the resources that they need so they can within themselves become functional individuals, but also create a strong community and families.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no huge desire to talk on this. Chair renews his motion that House File 1471 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Abler. Chair will move House File 1239. And this also goes to Health and Human Services.
Finance.
And the chair will also move deletion of Article 5 to get it in the shape the author wants. And so all in favor of that say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Article 5. Go ahead. That's a section 8. For the time you say it.
Just think of
the time saver. Well, Mr. Chair, the bill is far too large. And I appreciate you slimming it down. I do just want to offer a comment for the sake of the committee, what we took out, which I hope we can get rectified sometime. In 2005, there was a heinous crime. Mr. Rodriguez killed Katie Poyer, and it was terrible and tragic. In the wake of that, the legislature reacted and the executive branch, and they decided that some people who were able to work that couldn't work anymore because they were fine. And we overreached and we caused some harm to innocent people who had every right to continue working. I spent 8 years trying to help them work. And unfortunately, the part in this bill that would have helped them has run into trouble along the way. And so we'll work on it a different time. And but there were some people who were deemed able to work. There were 14,000. Of those 14,000 who had their disqualification set aside, one person offended in a minor way. So it's actually better than general population. That causes angst on the part of certain individuals. And so in the name of angst, we have a whole article gone, most of which is technical, Mr. Chair. But anyway, there's some wonderful child care bits here, which are left, which will make the child care world a much safer and better place. And to that, I'll turn you to my witnesses. And we need to discuss bleach later on. So the first we'll take the bill, and then we'll take the bleach thing, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'm sorry.
We'll testify to the bill, and then we can take the last amendment.
Oh, okay. You want to do it that way?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Laura Plummer-Zarust from the Department of Human Services, Office of Inspector General, Licensing Division. With the removal of Article 5, then this bill contains amendments related to the Human Services Licensing Act, some data practices provisions, some financial fraud and abuse provisions, and then one chemical health provision. So I will try to briefly highlight those.
Briefly, so that I'd like to let the committee members have an hour for Brady.
Yes, and we'll start with data practices, and I'll turn it over to my colleague because she has the first section.
Top speed. Mr. Chair and members, I'm Vicki Kunerth. I'm also with the Office of Inspector General, and I'm responsible for the Financial Fraud Investigations Division. The first provision of Article 1 has to do with our investigations. Current law allows us to disclose the fact of our investigations while they are active. What this language will do is allow us to limit that disclosure of the fact of active investigations where the disclosure would compromise the investigation. We have evidence of sometimes it actually even destroys and ruins our surveillance and investigations in some cases.
The other data practices provision relates to licensing data.
Ms. Rust.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I apologize for that. Again, back to the licensing data provisions. There's three things that this accomplishes. First of all, it makes the general nature of a temporary immediate suspension order, what is under investigation, the general nature of that public data. That is confidential data right now, so our temporary immediate suspensions, we can tell nothing basically about those. And that is responsive to some concerns that have been addressed to us. The second is making the existence of settlement negotiations, not the substance, just the existence, public data. And then the last is when we have a license holder or an applicant who is found responsible for maltreatment or disqualification, and then we say revoke the license, issue a sanction on that basis, that is public data. We're adding to that if the controlling individual is the individual responsible for maltreatment or a disqualification, and then say we revoke the license, that will be public data. So those are the data practices provisions. I'll move on to Article 2. Are the licensing provisions? I'll try to do so very briefly.
Yes,
okay, I will say in general that these are clarification in nature, and generally we try to clarify matters that come up in the interim that are raised that aren't clear enough for us. And perhaps it would be best if I just highlight a couple of examples. I certainly can go through section by section, but it is a long bill. Okay, so I'll mention one related to what I was just talking about, controlling individuals. We're clarifying that definition that doesn't include site directors who don't have an ownership or direction of the program interest. Highlight just a couple of others. Again, if you want to hear any others, we are requiring applicants to provide their federal tax ID. Last year, we required state tax ID, and we need the federal tax ID as kind of a gap there, and then requiring the name registered with the Secretary of State and any assumed names. Again, primarily technical, we are providing for the issuance of a conditional license when a disqualified individual has been ordered immediately removed and continues to be affiliated with the program. let me see here. We are establishing some timelines in statute for contested case, setting the contested cases on, the notice of order for hearing, the orders. Right now, there's only timelines in statute for our expedited temporary immediate suspension cases. And then many of these, I'll say, in conclusion regarding the licensing provisions, are related to clarifying the scope of the contested case hearing. What matters are in that hearing? If they're conclusive, they're not in the hearing. Conclusive means that the individual had a right to request a review of that below and did not do so, didn't exercise their right, essentially, is what that means. There are a number of technical amendments to 245B. What we're doing is last session, 245, home and community-based standards were passed into the law, but were not implemented because the legislature directed the department to go back and develop a cost recovery methodology. And so the provisions that passed amendments to 245B, the current standards, really weren't necessary until the full package goes forward this session. Trying to keep that a little simple, but it's technical in nature. Back to my colleague.
Vicki Kunerth with the Department of Human Services. Article 3 are four subdivisions that deal with our financial fraud and abuse investigations. Subdivision 1 and 4 grant us authority to have the option of using unmarked cars for conducting our investigations, both for our investigators in central office as well as our county investigators that we support through grants. This request particularly came from the counties because they weren't specifically authorized to use unmarked cars, and unmarked cars protects not only the surveillance activity but also the investigator. Subdivision 2 is language related to the facial recognition project between the Department of Public Safety and our agency that was passed last session. Department of Public Safety is very comfortable with the language we're bringing forward today. Starting this summer, Department of Public Safety will be sending us data from the Driver's License Bureau, where they have canceled driver's license because they have identified the same face on multiple driver's license with different names. What this language will do is make sure that, as well as the demographic data that we will need for our investigations, they'll also be sending us the photo. What this project involves is Department of Public Safety received a grant to use facial recognition software to identify the same face on multiple driver's licenses with different names. They initially found many instances of this, frankly over a million, but the large majority of them turned out to be very legitimate same face with multiple IDs, multiple driver's license. They could have been legitimate name changes, close relatives, marriages, you know, sisters, cousins, brothers, whatever. But for the remaining share, where the Department of Public Safety could not account for the same face associated with licenses with different names, they have canceled the driver's licenses, but they will be sending them to us to investigate to determine whether the person named with the various licenses does exist and whether they have public benefit cases associated with them and whether there really is a legitimate person with a legitimate public benefit case. And then finally, Subdivision 3 expands our access to deed agency wage detail and unemployment data so we can invest both providers as well as recipients. That's Article 3.
Mr. Chair.
Homer's Rust.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Article 4 contains one section, and that is a clarification regarding the documentation requirements for rate enhancements for chemical dependency programs. In this case, we're looking at chemical dependency programs that serve parents and their children and documenting that they meet the applicable child care requirements. Thank that you. Concludes.
Can we go to the one amendment?
I just want to say one thing, Mr. Chair. The coolest thing is about the facial recognition deal. Some people have multiple driver's licenses and have multiple medical assistance accounts or various human services things, and it's amazing the technology can catch up with people who are cheating. So in terms of the cool space age, you know, technology bit, that's pretty cool. So anyway,
except
thanks.
Reality isn't kept up with TV stuff.
It's not that cool, yeah.
Representative Franzen, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move the A3 amendment, please.
Okay, Representative Franzen moves the A3 amendment. Do you want to just briefly describe it?
Yes, actually, I just want to give a little explanation. First off, I'd like to thank Mr. Kerber there. He worked with some individual small business owners who happened to be child care providers in order to change a rule that they were, or a statute here regarding some bleach. Currently that there was, let's see here, an email here. There was a bleach variance form that providers have been able to fill out and have their parents sign that gives them the ability to use a product that is as effective as bleach if it meets the criteria. However, some counties, such as Ramsey County, adopted a stance that you cannot get a bleach variance without a doctor's note that specifies that a provider has an allergy to bleach and should not be using it. This statute just clarifies things a little bit and makes it so that they don't have to use the variance with the new rule from the department that these individual providers went and worked on with Mr. Kerber. So I thank you, Mr. Kerber, for that, and ask the members to.
Representative Avler, it's my understanding you accept that.
That's a great amendment, yeah.
Is there anybody that is against the amendment? Okay, then all in favor of Representative Franzen's motion to adopt the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
You can stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I was just going to ask if there's any questions. Representative Powell. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair and Representative Aber and testifiers, would you please explain the new language on page 12, lines 21 through 23?
Representative Aber.
Maybe I'll defer to my witnesses who spend their whole time doing this, Mr. Chair.
Is Plumber's Rest?
Or that was Mr. Chair. That's page 12, lines 21 through 23, the new language. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
This is amending the provision that governs correctional orders and conditional licenses. And conditional licenses may be issued based on a violation of law. We also have authority to issue orders of revocation, fines, suspensions based on violation of law. The statutory standard is looking at the nature and severity and chronicity. What this is aimed at is clarifying that we can issue a conditional license when a disqualified individual basically no longer lives in the home. This was the impetus for this is a Court of Appeals case. In which we had a family child care program. We issued a conditional license, and we issued that conditional license as there was a household member who had moved out. And in these cases, when individuals have moved out, revocation may not be warranted and indeed may not sustain challenge. So in these cases, this is a protection in terms of we issue a conditional license and we state in that conditional license that this disqualified individual may not reside or be present in the home. What that does then is the license holder, her or himself, has not otherwise violated the law, but we're making it clear that to protect the children or vulnerable adults in care, that that disqualified individual who no longer resides in the home must not be there, say, when children are present in the home. And so the way to do that is have a formal order and specify those conditions, that order then being public.
Ooh, public?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm head of the Inspector General's office. And I might just add that one of the other things that goes along with a conditional license is that, as Ms. Russ mentioned, you know, our first shot would be to revoke the license, but if the alleged perpetrator or the person who has a sex offender history or whatever has moved out of the home, we can't really sustain that order of revocation because the person that was the basis for the revocation is no longer living. We don't win those cases. And so what happens then is we want to, if we have to give a license to that family child care provider, then we'll give a license, but we want to give it on the condition that that guy can never come back. And when we do that, it becomes public. And it's also available then to the parents of the kids in care to know that. They can't know who it is from us, but they know that under this conditional license that's posted and it's online and the provider has to give them a copy, they find out that there is somebody who must not ever be in that home during the hours of operation. So it's really intended to provide much more protection for the kids in care. And I think there has been a little bit of misunderstanding about what this amendment is seeking to do. But it's really all about protecting kids.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Meyer.
May I also ask Representative Aber and testifiers about page 21, the new language in section 15. Could you elaborate and explain that, please?
Plumber's Rest.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this amendment, the new section, is clarifying that when we're talking about a family child care program, and many of those programs, the provider, her himself, has a child of their own that's home during the hours of care, that the regulations for family child care apply to the provision of care to that child. For instance, an example would be capacity. Okay, that child of their own counts in the capacity of the family child care program.
Representative Meyer? Okay, then Representative Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question comes on page 9, 9.20. And
having been in the not in this business, but having been in business, there's no requirement always to have a tax identification number. Is this going to many times you can use a Social Security number in lieu of your tax. This looks to me like you're going to force them to get a taxpayer identification number and include their Social Security number and the federal employee number. You know, and I can see if they have employees, but it looks like it's, to me, they should be able to operate with just their Social Security number many times if they don't have a taxpayer identification number. I guess that would be my concern is...
Ms. Plummer, Russ?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Howe, the intent of this provision is that, and it says, if they have employees, they're going to have a tax ID number, then a federal tax ID number. If it's an individual, then they won't have that. So it's really aimed at kind of distinguishing between if it's an individual versus an employer that would have employees would have a federal tax ID number.
And I agree. If you have a, Mr. Chair, if they have employees, I know they need to have that federal employer identification number. I guess I didn't. I thought you could still operate with a Social Security number in lieu of the state taxpayer identification number.
Mr. Chair, if you're looking at line 9.20. That's about the individual. It says the taxpayer identification numbers, so they would then describe whatever ones include that. I don't think they mean you have a numbers you don't have, but and if that's not clear, we can easily clarify that. Is that?
That, I guess it depends on how, right.
Because
I can see that.
Magnus asked the department, do you ever, in an individual, do you ever ask them for any number besides a Social Security number and whatever other ones they already have?
Mr. Chair, Jerry Kerber here. There's no intent here to require somebody to get a tax ID number who isn't already required to have a tax ID number. Our understanding from the research is that if you have employees, you have to have a tax ID number. You don't just operate off your own personal Social Security number. That's how it's been explained to us. And but if that is wrong, we're certainly not going to require it.
Representative Franson seems exercised by this point.
Hi. So no, I just wanted to explain... Some providers, Mr. Chair, thank you. Some providers choose to use their Social Security number. Others, like myself, when I did childcare, I had my own employer identification number because at the end of the year, you have to give a statement to the parents along with your either tax ID number or Social Security number. I wasn't comfortable with handing out my Social Security number. Some providers are, and that's the difference there. So it depends on how you want to run your business and how you want to, if you trust your families with your Social Security number.
Mr. Chair, although, I'm always happy when members read department bills because there's little details that they catch, and departments surprisingly don't actually always get everything right. They mostly do in general. I mean, without just so thank you for reading the bill.
Representative Ware.
Mr. Chair, would you please clarify which of the amendments have been moved? Is there an author's amendment?
They were actually drafted. People asked me if they could draft these, and I hadn't drafted them, but we're not offering any of them.
All right.
So the only...
Was there an author's amendment?
We deleted Article 5.
Right. Deletion of Article 5. That was Article 5.
Which amendment? What's the number of amendment?
An oral.
Oh, it's not a. It's just an oral amendment. Just deletion.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's just oral amendment, and then Representative Franson's was the other one. Those are the two.
That was the best one too.
Probably. Okay. I think people are Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. I came in late. We're jumping back between committees. You might have already covered this. Let me know if you have. And on page 45, we have some special language regarding personal care assistance that seems to eliminate some areas of...
Representative Barrett?
Yes.
You missed. We, well, that's no longer part of the bill, so.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, so, just Representative Barrett's sake, it's not removed because it's not a really good section of the bill. It's a really, really good section, but no just not for today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler. I'm disappointed to hear that Article 5 is out. I think it was the best part of the bill, no offense. But, I mean, I like the rest of what you're trying to do, too. But, and I know that's not anymore, so I won't say too much about it. But I just want members to know we all have a lot of constituents that are disqualified from work based on the DHS licensing standards. You probably know people that can't get a job because of the licensing restrictions. And just so members know, they can disqualify somebody based on just the preponderance of the evidence. That's the lowest standard of proof. It doesn't have to be a criminal conviction. It doesn't have to be clear and convincing evidence. They can actually disqualify somebody from employment based on the preponderance of the evidence. So I just think members should be aware of that. And I know Representative Abler has worked really hard to get people back to work, and I really appreciate the work that you've done on that.
I think there's others that can do with you. Okay. Then, no further questions. Then I'll renew my motion. Oh, I'm sorry. Does somebody really need to talk on this from the public? Okay. Then I'll renew my motion to pass House File 1239 as amended, and it goes to Health and Human Services Finance, correct? Okay. I said that's amended. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.